The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 125 in the Household of Faith and Reason, a Parable for Our Time, a paper presented by Carl Sandburg with comments by David Anderson and chaired by Greg Coford. This is a 60-minute session taped on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Side 2 will be blank.
Carl Sandburg. Immediately start thinking of Mark Twain and others of his vintage, and he hasn't disappointed me for a minute. I've just delighted in his humor and in his writings, as well as this deep thinking that he's put into his writings and the humor that's there with it. So I'm going to turn the time over to Carl Sandburg.
Some 35 years ago, I was at a university in the South in my first job, and I was enjoying fervent and happy activity in the church. At the same time, I was becoming aware of the character and the pernicious effects of the racial policies of the church at that time. The dissonance was great and grew ever greater, and as part of my soul's outcry, I wrote a piece in the manner of a parable. I got it out recently and read it to my family. They didn't understand it. I read it to my colleagues. They didn't understand it. I called in several passers-by off the street. They didn't understand it. I read it to my dog. He didn't understand it. I concluded that the text was now ready. Here it is. I'm responsible for what I say. You're responsible for what you hear. All is not well in the household of faith and reason. There are quarrelings and contentions and talk of separation. Judge now between them. Reason believes that he sees a wart on the end of faith's nose. He does not know whether the wart grew there after he espoused her, or whether he was not quite himself when he was a wooing and did not see it. Faith believes that her spouse's love has grown cold, for she does not see any wart, a proof that reason has proved himself perfidious. Since he insists on seeing a wart, reason says that he's sorry that he sees it, and he wishes it were not there. But as for denying it is there, he insists that he cannot. To say that he doesn't see something that he is looking at amounts to committing suicide, and is not about to blow his brains out over a wart. Gone are the sugared hours of their honeymoon, and their solicitous feelings, when reason in his virility rose to defend faith against every threat or slur, and when faith filled reason's solitary life with warmth and elan. Reason did not begin to see the wart until he had gone home with faith to meet her family, for they did not know very much about each other when they got married. The family dinner started auspiciously enough. Faith's mother was overjoyed that her daughter had married such a clean-cut young man, and her father that his new son-in-law was so full of prospect. Some of Reason's close relatives ran the Moral Generator Company, and others were on the board of the Corporation for Universal Happiness. He was their kind of people, they thought. He was one of them. Faith's mother was a practical and abundant soul. Her pantry was always full, 2 years full. And Faith's younger brothers and sisters, clean scrubbed and modestly dressed, bright-eyed and smiling, graced the table with innocent jollity. As Reason was admiring the lavish and bright-eyed virtue of the family and the sterling character of the parents, he noticed a teenager step in from the hallway. His neck was shaggy. His hair was shaggy, his neck unwashed. His eyes and lips emanated surliness. He wore a black leather jacket. His thumbs were hitched into the pockets of his blue jeans as he slouched out the door. There was the roar of a motorcycle engine, and he was gone. "Who was that?" asked Reason politely. "Oh, that was your brother-in-law, dear." "Oh," said Reason. "And then, I didn't see much of a family resemblance. He doesn't look like any of you." The eating stopped, the tongue fell silent, all eyes turned to look upon Reason. "Honey," said Faith's mother to her husband, "did you hear what that young man said about me?" And in the same instant, Faith's father, "That boy is as legitimate as any child in this family." And the children responded in chorus, "Yes, Dad." "Oh, certainly," said Reason, "I meant no harm." And the dinner group grew merry again. Reason learned that Faith's older brother ran an insurance company, that another was a great missionary, that another was not very intellectual, but he ran a successful construction company. All were prosperous and hardworking. "And where does that other brother work? What does he do?" "Oh, he doesn't work anywhere." "Well, that's strange. He isn't like any of you then." Again, the table grew silent. Faith's mother said, "Honey, I believe that young man is trying to insult me." Faith's father spoke, his voice stern. "That boy is as legitimate as any child in this family." And the children agreed in chorus, "Yes, Dad." From that day on, Reason has said he sees a wart on the end of Faith's nose. Until now, he has set aside 10% of his income for the works of Faith's family. But he is not keen anymore on supporting a lazy bum of a brother-in-law. And Faith thinks he's gotten downright grumpy. Meanwhile, the in-laws have gotten into it. Faith's family has fed her tales. Reason's Uncle Harry runs a wrecking company. His cousin Lucas committed suicide. And they said that when his brother had seen a woman and her daughter robbed and assaulted on a public street, he merely remarked that he found all that very natural, since hawks have always eaten pigeons. And besides, it's his business to observe and not to get involved. Faith says that she finds this family trait cropping out more and more in her husband, and which doesn't make him very pleasant to live with, you'll have to admit. Though you should hear how Reason's Uncle Empiricus, how he goes on at family gatherings, wondering out loud what Reason could have seen in that silly slip of a girl, and how he hopes that Reason will come to his senses. What's more, there are insidious rumors that the title to Faith's family's homestead is clouded. Moreover, the enterprise of Reason's family, Omnia Scientia, Incorporated, has been making hostile moves of a hostile takeover on the Fortune Cookie Factory, which heretofore has been the firm of Faith's cousins, Achievers, Believers, and Seers, Incorporated. Faith's relatives have botched every job they've taken on, says Reason's family. Jam yesterday, jam tomorrow, but never jam today. And Reason's family are sure that they have the key to straightening the mess out and establishing universal happiness, if only everyone would use a little common sense. They've come to quarreling about the dowry. Faith claims that it's hers and reverts to her in case of separation. Reason claims that it's part of their common property, and so a fair share reverts to him. And after all, Faith's great-great-grandfather embezzled it from Reason's family, says Reason. All is not well in the household of faith and reason. There are quarrelings and dissensions and talk of separation. Judge now between them. The parable, as I say, grew out of a personal situation, but it may also serve in a larger context to think about the issues which have created and are agitating our modern world of contemporary Americans, and which are currently being replayed within Mormonism. In the parable, faith and reason are wedded. Wedded because, by themselves, they are incomplete. As a human life, without both, is incomplete. Together, they are more than their parts. They give each the other what the other can, which neither can attain separately. What kind of girl is faith? By herself, in her essence, faith is an attitude of mind and spirit which shows the possibilities of the world in its better forms. What kind of guy is reason? By himself and in his essence, reason is an attitude of mind and spirit that insists on seeing the world clearly, that refuses to use the rubber yardstick, that always and ever wants to see in any situation all that is there and only what's there. Reason clarifies and faith shows possibilities. Together they create. They're the ideal couple and live together in harmony and mutual benefit until the appearance of a discordant and disruptive element that doesn't fit in the picture. And then the relationship between faith and reason needs to be rethought. At this point, we realize that there is more to faith and reason than we had realized. Each has a family, and therefore each has in-laws. In faith's family, there are several kinds of folks. There are those who are practical, industrious, productive, useful, and who make the world around them abundant. But there are some of her family who are anxious about their legitimacy. And the more they are secretly fearful, the more they are publicly staunch. They have attached themselves to a reassuring authority as barnacles to a passing hulk, be it a covenant, a mass movement, a party, or an institution. Reason is welcome in the family as long as he restricts his activity to proving the family's genealogy. And so we should not be surprised that faith's brothers and sisters do not raise many or any questions about the status quo and its inconsistencies. This is not their temperament. They just go to work and produce and don't ask so many questions. In fact, some of them say that things would go along a lot better in the family if reason would just quietly blow his brains out. And then there are those who are repugnant and unproductive, but who are defended as part of the family because they've always been there. As the cuckoo chick is fed by the mother and father robin along with the robin chick. Faith's family, let us say in the spirit of reason, is a mixed bag. And reason's family, he too has relatives of several different stripes. The pride of reason's family is the moral generator company because it generates in rational beings the sense of right and wrong and gives them the moral imperative and the modal verb ought. And the Corporation for Universal Happiness is reason's work for human good. For if humanity's problems are caused by error and ignorance, they can ultimately be solved by reason. On the other hand, there are some in the family who, let us say, lust after eminence and authority. Uncle Empiricus, we sense, doesn't want to be subject to a pope, but he wouldn't mind being one. And there are darker sides to reason's family, as we'll see. But let us say in the spirit of faith that the that the difficulties can be overcome. Faith's family welcomes reason as long as he is one of them, one of their kind of people, emphasizing their common points and echoing their view of themselves. But there are some things about the family backgrounds of each that threaten the compatibility of faith and reason and move them towards separation. To judge between them requires us to look in their historical context, clarify the issues, and recognize them in their contemporary form. And here we come to the handout. Faith and reason did not know much about each other when they got married. The medieval age of faith was moved by the confidence in the theology of the church to explain the world, its origin, its destiny, and its processes. Reason was there as the elaborator and defender of the harmony between the natural and supernatural world, between the revelation of the scriptures and the views of Aristotle, who was the master of them that know. Reason was the clarifier, the persuader of the mind, the logician, excluding all meanings except one. And we see the vigor of reason in St. Thomas Aquinas, in his Sum of Theology, for some 10,000 questions about all aspects of human existence are raised and demonstrably answered. We see it in Dante and the Divine Comedy, where all aspects of human life are placed by a sure and knowing mind. We see it also in the medieval cathedrals, encompassing all of existence, from the morn of creation to from the breach of innocence to the final judgment, and everything is put into its place. And this happy conjunction has had a long tradition in the West. The college that I taught at for most of my career, McAllister College, was founded by Presbyterians and took as its motto, Natura et Revelatio Caeli Gemini, nature and revelation, the heavenly twins. And at the entrance of the St. Paul Cathedral are inscribed the words in Latin, Go ye therefore and teach all nations. And on each side of the entry portals stands a figure with a torch, showing the means by which the church will carry out its teaching mission, one figure holding the light of revelation, the other the light of science and reason. Historically, the unwashed teenager, destroying the harmony of things, took the form of corruption of the church and the sterility and pernicious effects of some of its practices, such as the sale of indulgences. Something that we should be aware of is the near collapse of civilization in the 14th and 15th centuries. And it was out of this wide threat to civilization from the plague, which wiped out a third to the half of the population of the time, the corruption of the church, the recognition of that something was lacking. It is out of this that comes the Reformation. And in the Reformation, a critical reason became one of the chief arms of Calvin and others in purging out the accumulated errors and superstitions. Reason still in the service of faith. As the sectarian contest grew sharper, two forms of faith likewise emerged at opposite ends of the spectrum. The beginning of the modern world was, in the words of Martin Luther, My conscience I have from God and can give to no man. The individual became the ultimate judge of truth and belief, symbolized by Luther standing alone against the Pope and all Christianity, declaring, "Here I stand, I can do no other, God help me." Faith became the stance of the individual against the institution and very near kin of reason. In contrast, we have the words from the Jesuit order, which was founded to defend the interests of the Pope against the reformers, said one Jesuit authority, "One of the great consolations of the monastic life is the assurance that in obeying we can commit no fault. The superior may commit a fault in commanding you to do this or that thing, but you're certain that you commit no fault so long as you obey, because God will only ask you if you have performed what you have been ordered to do. Whether the things you did were opportune or whether something better might have been done, these questions are not asked of you, but rather of your superior. The moment that what you did was done obediently, God wipes it out of your account. As a passenger in a good vessel with a good pilot need give himself no further concern, but may go to sleep in peace, because the pilot has care over all, so a religious person who lives under the yoke of obedience goes to heaven as if while sleeping." It is no small thing of a truth to be able to cross the stormy sea of life on the shoulders and in the arms of another. Yet, that is just the grace which God accords to you who live under the yoke of obedience. Their superior bears all of their burdens. A certain grave doctor said that he would rather spend his life picking up straws by obedience than by his own responsible choice busy himself with the loftiest works of charity. Because one is certain of following the will of God in whatever one may do from obedience, but never certain in the same will, in the same degree of anything that we may do of our own proper movement. For Ignatius of Loyola himself, the founder of the order, obedience was the first and great commandment of the Jesuit order. On entering religion and thereafter, I ought to place myself entirely in the hands of God and of him who takes his place by his authority. I ought to desire that my superior should oblige me to give up my own judgment and conquer my own mind. In the hands of my superior, I must be a soft wax, a thing from which he is to require whatever pleases him, be it to write or receive letters, to speak or not to speak to such a person, or the like, and I must put all of my fervor in executing zealously and exactly what I am ordered. I must consider myself as a corpse, which has neither intelligence nor will, be like a mass of matter, which without resistance lets itself be placed where it may please anyone, like a stick in the hand of an old man, who uses it according to his needs and places it where it suits him. Faith became merely the stance of docility and conformity vis-a-vis the institution. This was an immense step, and one which we ought to ponder at some length. When religion becomes a contest over authority, faith and reason separate, and the wholeness of life is fragmented. As it happened, historically, faith and reason did separate, and the families assigned the blame. The in-laws get into it. The contest of faith and reason and the 17th century was the time when all of the fundamental intellectual questions were fought out. The 18th century simply gleaned and popularized and carried to logical conclusions those things that had been set forth in the 17th century. There was a critique of the faith. The moral critique of Christianity began during the 16th century wars of religion. Our religion, which was made to root out our vices, said Montaigne, serves only to cover them, to incite them, to nourish them. Again, if we were to sift out of all of the Protestant and Catholic armies of all of those who have fought for sincere religious purposes rather than plunder, we should scarcely be able to muster two companies of soldiers. The question was sharpened when, some 100 years later, in 1685, Louis XIV withdrew religious toleration from his kingdom and filled Europe and the New World with persecuted Huguenot refugees, and his spokesman defended it on the basis of the scripture. This question was agitated in many different ways. Can God command people to commit crimes? Reason tells us that God has to be at least as good as the best man in town. There is a philosophic critique of Christianity. Since the time of Thomas Aquinas, the notion of God or God had made his living by explaining the world. What happened at this particular time was that alternative ways of explaining the world, a philosophic materialism, was reborn from antiquity and philosophically made as much sense as the dogmas of Christianity. Omnia scientia, what's that? That's the enterprise of reason's family. The faith, the belief that all things are knowable. And we find this in Descartes' discourse on method. That as soon as we get a reliable science, which we get through the correct exercise of our reason, then man may become the master and the possessor of nature and can know all things. Science thrives on predictability. What happens then to the fortune cookie factory in which the future is told by revelation or arcane methods? Knowledge is better than faith because it's clearer, was the notion. The historical critique of Christianity, the genealogy of faith's family, and the deed to the homestead are clouded. This took place with the rise of textual criticism and the quest for the historical Jesus. It started back then. It continued through the 19th century, through the 20th century. The critique of reason, Uncle Harry's Wrecking Company. Yes. In the fierce religious controversies of the time, critical reason became a principle of destruction. It became evident that the Protestants could destroy the foundations of the Catholic position. Also, that the Catholics could destroy the foundation of the Protestant position. And who was left? Only the rationalists, the free thinkers, the libertine current that became the Enlightenment. One of the thinkers of the time said, I do not know, but what reason is like the corrosive acid that surgeons apply to the wound that eats away the infected part of the wound but then consumes the living flesh and bone as well. The moral critique of reason's family there is no empirical basis for morality. Now, true, Immanuel Kant, president of the Moral Generator Company, and he finds that within the rational endowment of the family, but this has not been the big feature of reason's family that has moved toward technology and science and ends up with power detached from goodness. Cousin Lucas committed suicide. Camus, in his essay The Myth of Sisyphus, begins with this statement: there is only one truly philosophic question, that of suicide. Is life worth the living? If it is, then we can turn our attention to the secondary questions of philosophy. This was in 1940, when I see this as a time when reason was brought to bay. The endowment, or the dowry, well, what is the dowry? The dowry is the will to do good, to keep human life from self-destruction, and the reach for transcendence, connecting to the larger sphere. This is the mutual share of faith and reason, deriving from each of them. What will happen to that dowry if they separate? Now, we'll come to Mormonism. In the beginning, they were wedded. In 1831, Parley P. Pratt traveled around the Kirtland area visiting branches of the church. He said, some very strange spiritual operations were manifest, which were disgusting rather than edifying. Some people would seem to swoon away and make unseemly gestures and be drawn and disfigured in their countenances. Others would fall into ecstasies and be drawn into contortions, cramps, fits, etc. Others would seem to have visions and revelations which were not edifying and which were not congenial to the doctrine and spirit of the gospel. Well, there's no denying that the folks of the revivalistic community of that time were fully persuaded. If we need only the yea-saying of the passions or the revels of the spirit, we need go no further. But when Joseph inquired about these things, another revelation came in DNC 50. It says, in effect, that revelation from God is both rational and self-verifying. He that preacheth and he that receiveth understand one another, and both are edified and rejoice together. And that which does not edify is not of God and is darkness. That which is of God is light, and he that receiveth light and continueth in God receiveth more light, and that light groweth brighter and brighter until the perfect day. The same test is also implied in the Book of Mormon in Alma 32. The test of the goodness of the seed, the word, is whether it sprouts and brings forth increase in our understanding and in the living of our lives. It was this particular moment in the church which I think represented a crossroads and kept Mormonism from simply degenerating into another frontier text. Sect, pardon me. There's also within Mormonism a rational check on the institution and its hierarchy. I can get along without some revelations in the Doctrine and Covenant. I can't get along without section 121. Because what it says there is that priesthood can function only by persuasion. Section 121 is a venture of faith in reason. The principle is constantly put to the test, and the test has been passed or failed a good many times since the beginning of the church. If you want an example, go to Ron Walker's recent book on wayward saints, The History of the Godbeites. Mormonism is the two-winged bird. The Mormonism I grew up with and signed on to was the expansive, open-ended Mormonism. I got it from 2B Brown, and he got it from B.H. Roberts, Talmage, and Widsell. It formed the ethos of the church until about 1950, at which time the church moved into much more direct contact with the rest of the world, and out of which developed a garrison mentality of getting the wagons in the circle. The defensive distrust of the world. And I found this in the writings of Joseph Fielding Smith and Bruce R. McConkie, and this has been the predominant mode since the rise of correlation. Well, where are we today? Are we once more in the situation of faith and reason separating? There's an end to the parable. Faith and reason separated and went their own ways. And then after long months and years, reason knocked on faith's door, and she bade him come in. He was weary and slumped down on the sofa. "I just had to talk with you, honey. I don't know how to tell you this, but I wrote a check for universal happiness, and it bounced. And Uncle Empiricus has been kiting checks. He can't cover them all. Been promising more than he can deliver." "Oh," said Faith, "is that bad? My family does that all the time." Here, reason, usually so clear-sighted, noticed something about Faith. "Are you knitting something?" he asked. "Yes," answered Faith. "Booties?" And Faith cuddled her eyelids demurely. "Yes, it is true. Reason has never been so strong and self-sufficient that he has not needed to visit Faith on the sly." And as the two of them contemplated the booties, the old relationship came back. As they say, the virginity of Hera was renewed in her yearly bath. And in not a minute too soon, for we must end on good news and bad news. The good news is that the world is a mess. A striving, crazy, half-finished something in the process of becoming something else. The bad news is that each one of us is a mess. Each a striving, crazy, half-finished something in the process of becoming something else. And we need faith and reason together. True it is that reason cannot promise universal happiness or warrant the success of omnia scientia, but he can keep the record, he can keep the yard straight and root out the crabgrass. Nor can faith, tender thing that she is, promise to set the world entirely right. But what is the world, what is the youth, what is the old age, when she is not swelling with possibility? And when it comes right down to it, it's not so hard to keep them together. All we have to learn how to do is keep them separated from their in-laws.
Thank you, Carl. Religion without science is blind. At the end of the parable, Carl suggests a comforting reconciliation in which faith and reason have a child together, perhaps not their first or last, which binds them together in a common purpose. In the less playful part of his paper, he proceeds to catalog some of the tensions between faith and reason in Christian and Mormon history and thought. In these sections, I find fewer grounds than I'd like for the optimistic conclusion of the parable. Carl is correct, I think, in saying that the exciting promise of the 1831 revelation, DNC 50, is that revelations from God are both rational and self-verifying. He then provides his own explanation of what this means. It is not just the hearing of the revelation that leads to the rational verification, he suggests, but the coherence of the revelation with a growing body of understanding, coupled with a pragmatic confirmation of its goodness or futility in one's life. Carl concludes that ultimately the goodness and correctness of a revelation has to be decided by the light within each individual, which, as he says again, involves a pragmatic confirmation of the revelation's goodness or futility in one's life. Of course, for intellectually driven Mormons, there is not a single propositional revelation called the Restoration to which they are asked to ascend. Rather, there are a large number of ostensibly inspired utterances, all deemed fundamental by the Mormon community or mainstream Mormonism. Unfortunately, some of these utterances may appear as rational vagrants without visible means of support. More importantly, many of these utterances are, taken by themselves and in isolation, incapable of the kind of pragmatic confirmation, their ultimate goodness or futility in our lives, that Carl commends to us. Some examples may help. Section 132 was the jewel in the crown of Joseph's restoration, yet its actual pragmatic goodness or futility cannot presently be ascertained except by excommunicated fundamentalists. Further, when we read the best accounts of its historical practice, I think authored by Richard Van Wagner and by Todd Compton, we are led to the conclusion that as practiced, it was a principle incompatible with simple truth-telling. For Joseph, this was the simple truth of who he was marrying and when and for what reasons. For Brigham and other patriarchs, the unspeakable truth was that in return for promised eternal exaltation, only the patriarch could ensure, the plural wife would be inevitably denied the male companionship and loving support that a respectable single husband would be expected to provide as a matter of course. Second example, in the form of a question: how is it possible to verify pragmatically, by living and finding its goodness confirmed in the living of our lives, the teaching that God curses human beings with dark skins in order to mark them as unworthy of the privilege of priesthood, or in the case of Lamanites, the society and esteem of their light-skinned cousins? Forgive me, but in the late 20th century, we should be able to see that this question is purely rhetorical. It has only one answer. And it was rhetorical, as Hubie Brown recognized, with respect to persons of African descent long before 1978. Perhaps in Carl's parable, these are the part of the wart on faith's nose. Inside that story, I'd be more inclined to call them part of a fearsome meanness that reason finds in her heart. How deeply is it entrenched, and can therapy heal it? I give these examples not to argue that Carl is wrong about the process of confirming religious truth in our minds and hearts in the manner he suggests. I think he is right about that process. Rather, my purpose is to point out that some conclusions, or perhaps I'd like to point out some conclusions, or perhaps just issues for further discussion, that I believe are sharply implicated by his historical remarks. What are the conclusions or issues? One is that the kind of existential confirmation Carl describes comes down, finally, to the choosing and persisting in a way of life. That is, Carl's process is well suited to selecting a set of core beliefs that will guide us through the myriad circumstances and activities of our lives. It is less well suited, as the preceding examples are meant to show, to the selection and verification of all the individual revelations and doctrines urged on us by our traditions and by our religious community. So perforce, the program Carl suggests involves a picking and choosing among revelations and doctrines. Indeed, we may choose to live as Mormons or as Christians in spite of and not because of certain well-settled doctrines and revelations. Some doctrines, it turns out, are suspect and may have to be rejected on purely rational grounds. Others have to be rejected, darn it, because they just don't taste good. At the table of ideas, we may say, they simply don't pass the mustard. As we engage in this process of selection, though, we may be lonely. And perhaps that is as it should be. For Christians, our strangers and pilgrims, sometimes even in the mainstream of the community that gave them life. And as Jesus said, the sword of truth has to be wielded with gentle courage, even among those we love best. I'd like to end with some personal comments. They are prompted by Carl's paper, although they don't comment on his paper directly. I've been reading a lot of science lately about what the nature of the physical universe is, and I'm amazed at how little people who know far more than I know, and what the possibilities for the final description of that physical universe might be. It's led me to the following observations. We yearn for perfection and completeness. We imagine the experience of reaching out through the almost endless conceptual space, and finally, with the quivering, straining fingers of our understanding, arriving at the limit of all there is, brushing, as it were, the glassy, smooth, concave limits of not just human being, but being itself. That is the passion of reason and its obedient, well-behaved child, science. And yet we know this experience is denied us in our present state as surely as we know we live. It is, as Sartre said in a few of his telling words, a futile passion. It is the passion to be God. So the clock ticks, and despite our passion, the cells listen as we march unwillingly toward the dark uncertainty of the grave, from which no being yet has emerged to hold a press conference. And yet this ignorance of ours may not be a curse, but a blessing. For in our ignorance and and uncertainty, there is opportunity. Opportunity made possible by the very ignorance that plagues us. What is that opportunity? The opportunity is to discover and announce, not always in that order and often unwittingly, who we are. This is our precious opportunity to forgive the socially unforgivable and to mend our ways before they become fixed in the freeze we call memory and eventually history. Because we are so incomplete and ignorant, the physical and moral world we inhabit remains ambiguous and open to us. We are not constrained by the splendor and horror of omniscience. And yet, and so, Jesus lived the only path I can, in my present ignorance, commend to you. He was unafraid of what others, especially those of high standing, thought of him. Indeed, Jesus saw and taught that although with God nothing is impossible, having high standing in the community is generally a liability, not an asset. He was not afraid of being homeless and being rejected. Eventually, at the behest of powerful, well-connected men, he was lifted up like a hissing serpent in the moral wilderness. But do not recoil. Things are not as they seem, in case we haven't noticed. Returning to the place where we always long to begin, and knowing it for the first time, we are free to speak the truth, with Pelatiah Brown, even in Joseph's fear-laden community, untrammeled. The twisted serpent man on the rack you see, close your eyes to see more clearly, is the Son of God. At the time, or was it the fullness of time, this was the best God had to offer. The story, then, of how a marginal Jew ended up in the worst Rome, ended up on the worst Rome had to threaten, begins and ends in beguiling paradox. In the beginning, the wily serpent Lucifer explained it all to God in the garden. Knowing Lucifer, the light-bearer, to be the father of lies, God placed a passionate love of truth, capital T, into the hearts of the children of Eve. I will place enmity between you and the seed of the woman, God warns the serpent. And Lucifer shoots back. Then with that very enmity, this love of truth and goodness you're placing in their hearts, I will buy up crusading armies and navies blessed by well-meaning, truth-seeking priests and rule with blood and horror on the earth. It's an impressive return of service. Advantage Satan. No wonder Satan looked up at the crowd and the digital scoreboard and laughed. So the story begins in beguiling paradox. Does it also end there? Yes. But the beguiling is now transformed, and the paradox must be given new life. Late in our century, when Auschwitz and Nuremberg are no longer simple place names, the beguiling is urgent and past irony, to show kindness and gentleness and love unfeigned. As Auden prophesied, before the Holocaust, we must love each other or die. So perhaps the crucial paradox, too, foretold by a derisive liar, can only be healed in the guts of we the living. This paradox is felt anew when we are wounded, even in the house of our faithful friends. And yet, such wounds are not unto death. And as Jesus showed, they are emblems of the best God has to offer.
Call for any questions that you have. It looks like we're coming up on 11 o'clock, and so if anyone has a question, let's try to make it direct to Carl. And Carl, I'm going to sit down and take that question.
Question?
In the parable that you've drawn, what do you see as the immediate future for the church? I see assimilation taking place, and from a sociological standpoint, the blacks receive the priesthood. We have a lot of different issues we get into. And as that assimilation takes place, we have President Hinckley speaking in San Francisco indicating that a famous, I can't say scripture, but a theoretical concept we have about as man is, God once was, as God is, man may become, saying this is more of a cootlet. And so I'd just like your response on that.
Well, I believe it is a time of great change in the church. Old things are passing away. People who experienced Mormonism in the 30s and 40s early 50s had a different kind of experience than those who experienced it in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I sense immense energies in the church. Every time I walk on the BYU campus and feel all of this energy coming from all parts of the world and project that back to other to those parts of the world, I say to myself, there's something very big here, and I don't believe anyone has a hold on it. It will have a mind of its own. Things will work out in ways which we don't expect. But there's one thing which will continue to be the question, is what is the role of the individual, and what is this relationship between faith and reason? I'd like to quote a sonnet by George Santayana about the nature of faith. O world, thou choosest not the better part. It is not wisdom to be only wise, and on the inner vision close the eyes. It is wisdom to believe the heart. Columbus found the world and had no chart, save one which faith deciphered in the skies. To trust the soul's invincible surmise with all his knowledge and his only art. Our knowledge is a torch of smoky pine that lights the way but one step ahead. Bid then the tender light of faith to shine, by which alone the human heart is led across a void of mystery and dread. And to the thinking, the thought divine. This, for me, is a recurring part of humanity. It will recur because it needs to recur for us to find our way in this crazy world. Whatever changes take place, there will be faith showing possibilities, and there will be reason telling us what is possible and clarifying. But in any case, I believe that Montaigne has said the final word on this question for the modern world. Be he seated atop the highest throne in the world, still must each one sit on his own behind.